welcome back. For those of you who are worried, we don't have quite as long to go as it looks. Okay, so this is our final session of presentations. And our first speaker is Giles Yeo. He was born in San Francisco and received his undergraduate degree from UC Berkeley. He then moved to Cambridge with Sidney Brenner to do his PhD. And he then joined the laboratory of Professor Stephen O'Reilly, who works on the genetics of obesity. And he is now a senior research associate and group leader at the University Metabolic Research Labs, and as well as a graduate tutor and fellow of Wolfson College. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. Oh, hello.
The light's not working.
Oh, wait a minute. It's fine.
The light's over here.
Hello, guys. Thank you to the organizers for inviting me. I think I was invited because I study the brain control of food intake and body weight, which is what I do. However, I started my life, or at least my postdoctoral life, as a geneticist with Steve O'Reilly. And it has shaped and influenced my thinking and the way I've thought about things since. And so, really, I've been put in this genetics session. But I'd like to look at the mechanisms, the brain control of food intake, through the prism of genetics, for lack of a better term. So I want to talk to you guys today about some of the genetic factors controlling food intake and body weight. So now, I think we've seen a dozen versions of what is in effect with this graph. Okay, and this graph really masks the complexity of pretty much all of the talks which we've heard today, meaning that we have a shift in body weight. Now, the reasoning for this shift in body weight, we have heard a zillion reasons today. And the reasons for the shift, however, is largely environmental, just based on the fact that one was in 85 and one is 2007. These were the data extracted from the Center for Disease Control, the U.S. This is U.S. data. But as certainly John Bundell spoke this morning, the thing to take here is that the shift in the shape of this curve is not bimodal. You know, it doesn't look like the Golden Gate Bridge, but it's a change in the shape of the curve. And the reason why there's a change in the shape of the curve is because different people respond differently to this so-called change in environment. And I would like to argue that a large part of this is due to genetics. And so the tagline that I've always had is that, obviously, the environment makes you obese, but how obese you become is very powerfully genetically determined. And so here are some things of genetic control of body weight, a lot of which you've heard today, so I'm not going to belabor the point. Variable response to the same environment. Ethnic groups of some people, data from twin and adoption studies, a lot of work that was actually done here. And it's worth actually considering this. But depending on who you believe and who you read, that the heritability of fat mass, the so-called 40 to 70% that everyone always talks about, is actually at least equivalent to, and according to many people, actually greater than that of height. And so I think that's something. It's something to consider, that there is a powerful genetic element to obesity. Now, I think there are two different ethos to handling the genetics of obesity. There is the looking at severe obesity, so the extreme phenotypes. This is what Steve O'Reilly is famous for, and I'll talk to you. And that's where I started my life, and I'll talk to you something about that. And then there's the second half, which is studying the common obesity, which is perhaps more relevant to most of us, but infinitely more difficult for a number of different reasons. So the first part, I'm just going to very briefly go over some examples which of severe genetic cases of obesity, which we've worked out some mechanism for, and then spend a little time speaking about the common obesity in particular, the gene I'm working on at the moment, which is FTO. So the first handle, we've heard about leptin, was leptin. Okay, we know what leptin was, and it was really this that started certainly my clinical colleagues, Dr. Faruqi, Professor Rahi, to actually start collecting severe cases of obesity. And I was brought on as the kind of like the geneticist, the guy who could actually do the genetics work. And you've seen this picture already here from Paul Fletcher about the treatment of obesity. But what about the treatments of leptin deficiency? But what leptin deficiency actually did, in addition to A, help these kids, was to open up a whole new area of biology and a whole new area for actually us to work on. And now we know that leptin signals obviously to the brain and actually causes changes in the feeding behavior. But it's useful to remember that, you know, there are a number of people today have actually spoken about various elements of the melanocortin pathway. Here are POMC, we talked about the MC4 receptor, we've talked about any number of different things, but that the entire pathway here is, to a large part, leptin-dependent and signals downstream of leptin. And this so-called leptin-melanocortin signaling pathway, the entire pathway here was determined by genetics, okay? Human genetics, rodent genetics, and genetically modified rodents, but in particular the human genetics added relevance to the whole thing. And if you actually have mutations at every single point, here, you end up with a severely obese human being, as obese as I showed you in the picture before, or a severely obese rodent. And the next thing to actually think about was that all of these so-called monogenic causes of obesity, both human and rodents, are all of molecules that happen within the brain, okay? Thus, being here today, except for leptin, but that signals to the brain. And I haven't listed all the other molecules that are here, BDNF, which was mentioned, TrkB, which is BDNF's receptor, SIM1, which is responsible for the development of parts of the brain, all result in monogenic causes of obesity, all of which occur within the brain. Okay, so obesity is a brain disease. It's worthwhile just highlighting a couple of examples. And once again, the mechanism, but from the prism of genetics, of POMC, for example. So POMC is an interesting molecule for those of you who know. It's a complex polypeptide that's produced into a number of different melanocortins, and it actually it mediates a rather varied biological different phenomenon based on the melanocortin peptides binding to five different receptors. And you can see any number of different things. For example, the MC1 receptor, in which, so aside from the MC2 receptor, and ACTH, which is a monogamous relationship, so to speak, all of the other melanocortin peptides are actually relatively promiscuous for any number of different receptors. And you can see any number of different things, including skin and hair coloration, steroidogenesis, like I mentioned, energy homeostasis, and even down to sebum production, the natural oils that are actually present within there. And when you actually have a mutation, and this was work not done by us, but we have also POMC deficient human beings, is that when you actually don't have any POMC at all, you then see the phenotype based on this varied response. So you, first of all, you get red hair, okay, pale skin, because of a lack of MSH activity on the MC1 receptor. You have adrenal insufficiency because of a lack of ACTH, adrenocorticotropin, on the MC2 receptor, and you are severely obese. Maybe not so in this particular picture, but severely obese because of a lack of MSH activity on the MC4 receptor. And we went on to knock out the POMC in mice and showed pretty much the same type of phenotype that's there. And then we found that mutations within the MC4 receptor also resulted in obesity. But this then came with a difference, where this was then the first obesity gene which showed itself to be dominant, and where lacking one copy was actually enough to actually make you obese, unlike all the other molecules upstream of here, leptin, leptin receptor, POMC, which are all recessive disorders. So therefore you need two copies. What is the function of that actually happening? The function of that actually happening is the fact that it was then more common. It's still rare, but it was then more more common. And when we actually screened, and now of these of our cohort of severely obese kids, that was Sadaf's cohort of severely obese, 4,000 kids, we probably have about 6% of these kids. Okay, these are severely obese rather than anything else, with pathogenic, empirically shown in the lab, pathogenic mutations in the MC4 receptor. And what happens when you have 4,000, 5%? When you have 200 different mutations, is you're then able to have a look and look at the so-called genotype-phenotype correlation from genes to behavior, the word being used today. And unsurprisingly, MC4 receptor is a G-protein coupled receptor, and when you have a number of different mutations on there, you can have some receptors that are completely dead, okay, no function at all, and then you have some which are partially functional. What is interesting is if you actually try and keep some level of homogeneity here, so we take heterozygous patients who are either heterozygous for fully dead MC4 receptors or partially, what you can actually see is just based on this in itself, you are able to measure their behavior in some appreciable fashion. Okay, and here is in a situation where if they're put in an ad libitum test meal, so here is leptin deficiency, for example, here's treated leptin deficiency, here controls, you'll see that the patients who are heterozygous for a completely inactive MC4R, okay, actually eat more, and you would predict that they would eat more, just based on the compared to the patients who are partially functional for this. And this all entirely, the prediction was based on what in effect is a cell culture test. The issue here, of course, okay, and is that the study of severe early onset obesity has been invaluable, and has been invaluable. One of the criticisms that I had when I was working on severe early onset obesity was the fact that, you know, you're studying, in effect, and I will use this, I'm quoting other people, you're studying freaks. We're not studying freaks, we're studying human beings, but we're studying freaks, okay? Because they're so severely obese, it has no function at all, and no relevance at all to the regular human population. However, what it has done, and that in some way perhaps might be true, but what that has done, it has illuminated critical pathways controlling food intake and body weight. And so it has given us new biology. And I would argue that that has been worth every a penny of time that has been spent studying these so-called freaks. However, the major problem is that the major burden of disease, obesity in this particular situation, is carried by those of us with common obesity, okay, the so-called common obesity, and to date has resisted yielding any meaningful biological insight at all. But not about the mechanisms controlling food intake, but what genes in particular could actually be responsible for the differences in common obesity or cause of common obesity. Now, Dr. Kennedy here has given a good background on what GWAS is, so I won't have to go into it. But we are now in the so-called post-GWAS era, okay? The post-GWAS era, and we now have a number of different genes. 32, I think, is the count that have come up that are associated with common obesity. Now, as it turns out, the first one, and I'll come back to why it was important that we're still working on the first one, is FTO. Which is a fat mass and obesity-related transcript. And there are a number of SNPs within intron 1 of FTO which are associated with obesity. And what happens is, if you have the AA risk allele compared to if you have the TT risk allele, you are, on average, 3 kilograms heavier. Now, 3 kilograms for the Brits here times 2.27 is about half a stone. It's about 7 pounds, and you go, well, what does that got to do with the price of eggs? And people, once again, so like when I was studying monogenic causes of obesity, and people said that what's the relevance of this? People now ask, why are you studying a gene in which it only transfers 3 kilograms of 3 kilograms of weight difference? My argument here is that the fact that it's this particular thing. Okay. Now, this is not the only allele there. There are some 27 or something different associated alleles. Although it only confers 3 kilograms extra weight, up to 16% of the population, read species, okay? Can't be homozygous for risk alleles for FTO. So nearly a billion people in the world will have, on average, be 3 kilograms heavier entirely because of their FTO status. You look, everyone here, 16% of you. Now, not only that, if you're actually heterozygous for it, the likelihood is you'll be 1.5 kilos slightly heavier. So my argument there is, although the effect is small, it's affecting the body weight of so many people, and I'm interested to know why. So what? There is a knockout mouse, as it turns out, and it was published in Nature, I forgot what year it was, 2009, there we go. And it had a rather provocative title, Inactivation of FTO Gene Protects from Obesity. The major problem here is that it's not as easy as it looks, and it's not as straightforward as it seems, because this mouse is not lean, it's small. But it is hyperphagic, it eats more compared to its body weight. There is some evidence of an increase in energy expenditure. They have a worrying a decrease in activity, but I shall actually come here. But the most compelling piece of evidence in here is that the heterozygous mice are resistant to diet, high-fat diet-induced obesity. So although it probably, FTO, I think, has something to do with energy homeostasis, but the knockout mouse is not telling us anything here in particular, because it's too complex a scenario. So what, in keeping with the brain theme, what we found out was that FTO is ubiquitously expressed, but highest expressed within the brain. Within the brain, you can see that it lights up areas in the hypothalamus that we should be of interest, so that's the arcuate nucleus, the VMN, the DMN, and the paraventricular nucleus. And I have another program in which I look at the response of the hypothalamus to afferent nutritional signals. So we use laser capture and microdissection to remove little bits of brain. And the interesting thing is, when you actually fast an animal, it turns out that they drop their FTO expression, but only specifically within the arcuate nucleus, not in the VMN, not in the DMN, not anywhere else. And when you actually put the animals on a high-fat diet, they actually increase FTO expression. So we were interested in FTO within the arcuate nucleus, and when we actually looked, what was FTO expressed with? Was it expressed with a number of other arcuate peptides that were there? Well, it was expressed with POMC, but we think that FTO is widely expressed throughout the arcuate nucleus. So now, if nutritional regulation in both directions, fasting and high-fat diet, actually can cause FTO levels to fall or rise, what happens when we actually manipulate FTO levels? And so what we did was we used bilateral injections of virally driven either siRNA or shRNA or FTO-cDNA to actually overexpress and knock down FTO. And in effect, what we saw was that when we knocked down FTO, we managed to increase food intake. And when we increased FTO, we managed to knock down food intake, specifically within the arcuate nucleus. And when we picked another area of the hypothalamus, when we decreased FTO, nothing changed, which is different from the arcuate nucleus, and that's not very far away from that. Whereas when we actually increased FTO, we did manage to decrease food intake. So showing that we're able to take one of these GWAS genes and be able to work out its biology. And this is my last slide. And this was covered once again by Dr. Kennedy. But the bottom line is here. So FTO is here. It's the highest change. It's 3 kilograms. But how about all of these other 32 or 31 genes, but put together, all of their effect weight does not even reach what FTO is. Okay, we've seen that graph. However, most of these are expressed within the brain. Okay, and so I just like to say that obesity, in the end, whether monogenic or polygenic, is a brain disease. So there we go. I'd like to acknowledge the crew that did the work, and this is where I work. Thank you very much.
What is that? One question? Does someone have a quick question?
Thank you. Thank you for your presentation. I have a problem with your first slide and the rest of your presentation.
Okay.
If you look at the first slide, which is basically the epidemic of obesity,
yep.
It means that over time and over a fairly short period of time,
yep.
Something changed in our genetics.
No.
If you want me to believe that genetics is a very important factor in explaining the the obesity epidemics, it means that something changed in our own genetics, because over 20 to 25 years, lots of people became very heavy. So how do I reconcile the first slide with the rest of the presentation?
Okay, just to make it clear, the reason for the change in the shift is 100% environmental. Okay, 100%. The reason for the shift in this thing. I'm talking about why have not everyone, it's the same question, how come everyone in America is not obese? That is because we all responded differently to that. And what I'm saying is that this is 100% environment, but the difference in how we have responded, that's genetically determined. That is the argument I want to make. The difference in how we responded.
Thank you.